This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham.
Ever see the CBS TV drama Person of Interest? Every episode starts like this.
You are being watched. The government has a secret system, a machine that spies on you every hour of every day. I designed the machine to detect acts of terror, but it sees everything. Violent crimes involving ordinary people. The government considers these people...
Fiction, to be sure. Or is it? How much information is the government collecting on us? What are they doing with it? A group of Virginia scientists are now pondering those questions and many, many more about the phenomenon of big data. What they find could affect everything from espionage to medicine. Three of those researchers have agreed to talk with us about their new mission right after the news.
If your number's up, we'll find you.
I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. How much information do you process on a daily basis? How much are others around you processing? How is all this information overload being dealt with in our world? And could it be affecting us in ways that most of us never even realize? Big data is our topic today, and apparently it has implications in all of our lives in just about every way imaginable. Some examples... Well, might scientists miss out on finding a cure for cancer as soon as possible because they don't have a good enough method for correlating huge amounts of data? Would soldiers in a far-off war zone have a much better chance of returning home safely if only their commanders had better algorithms for examining threat assessments? Could your name end up on a terrorist watch list because a computer code did not work precisely the way it was supposed to? Getting the idea? The concept of big data is so, well, big that it's hard to overstate its importance. Now, a group of researchers at the University of Virginia have been tasked with coming to terms with just what big data means and what our top priorities in dealing with it should be. Among those investigators, a man who's created landmark computer models used in DNA sequencing, molecular biologist Bill Pearson. A scientist who's created mathematical algorithms that have been used to save lives on the battlefield and in pediatric intensive care units. System engineer Don Brown. Plus, by phone, a researcher who's won international attention for his mass media investigations, author of the book The Googleization of Everything, Siva Vaidyanathan. Gentlemen, thank you all for making time for us.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Don Brown, since you're the mathematical guru here, let me turn to you first. How do you define big data, and what would you say is its importance?
Okay, well, let me start by saying that I don't think the notion of collecting data is anything new. We've been collecting data as human beings since we notched on trees and wrote on tablets. What's new is today we're able to collect data in lots of different ways. We have sensor systems. We have surveys. We have ways to collect data that we've just never had before. And because of that, we've been able to use this massive amount of data that we've been collecting for all sorts of things, some extraordinarily good things. You mentioned the example that I've been involved in, which is, in fact, predicting threats against IED attacks against U.S. forces. We've been able to take...
And these were actually algorithms that you created that the U.S. military has been using in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. They've been able to use that in order to predict areas that are threatened for attack. And effectively, what we've been able to do is show how you can bring in lots of data that's geo-referenced, which means that it's referenced in space. It's also referenced in time, so we know the characteristics over a patterning of years and months and those kinds of things. And we've been able to use that data effectively to show where the threats are. So what's different about big data is the fact that we've been able to collect massive amounts of information from lots of different sources to use it effectively to solve these kinds of questions.
Well, people certainly can imagine that if you have come up with more effective ways to predict where the threats are likely to be on a battlefield or in a war zone, that your work is saving lives. But from what I understand of your work, Don, there are countless other areas where you've come up with ways to collate lots and lots, huge amounts of information. that also have implications for life-saving. One of them was relationships between or possible relationships between the weather and being admitted to an emergency room for heart problems?
Well, actually for COPD, for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, for okay. lung problems. Yes, that's exactly right. We took data across, in fact, the Shenandoah Valley, and we looked at the environmental conditions across the valley for a period of about 10 years, and we looked to see what kind of conditions were related to increased admissions of COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And we found that, in fact, the temperature correlated quite strongly with the admission patterns of these for these patients. Now, this is a big deal because that allows hospitals to plan more effectively for their admissions when they're going to see increased admission rates.
Well, maybe we can get back to that, but I got to ask right now, what temperature results in higher admissions?
It's actually cold temperature. The colder the temperature, the more the admission. And it actually is a kind of an interesting phenomenon because it turns out that when the temperature drops and then rises again and drops, that kind of increased variance is what causes the increased admission rate.
Hey, Siva Vaidyanathan, I don't know if anybody's ever argued that your work saves lives. I could see how they might. But, you know, you come at this whole concept of big data from a completely different perspective. So tell me how you would define the term and why you think it's important.
Well, yeah, I mean, nothing I've ever written has saved a life nor cost a life, as far as I can tell, which is nice. But you know, I'm the guy in this conversation whose role is to step back and ask questions about how we're proceeding, what sorts of choices we're making as a society, what are the implications, both positive and negative, to these sorts of innovative ways of understanding the world. Now, I loved how Don described data, right? Data is the etchings that human beings make in the world for the sake of, you know, recalling and reading. But they're all data is also the etching that we make to record what we observe about the natural world. And what we've seen in the past 20 years is a tremendous increase in our ability to manipulate, to gather, to manipulate, to analyze, to compare and contrast huge collections of data. And that's pretty spectacular. It means that we can imagine doing things such as Don's work, right? Doing things in ways that can make us more efficient, make us more powerful, make us wiser, make us smarter. But they can also cost us, right? If we imagine that people who might not mean to act in our best interest have tremendous records of our comings and goings, and can predict our comings and goings with the same accuracy as Don's able to predict various afflictions or you know, bad results on a battlefield. You can see how quickly that could be abused. That sort of power can be abused. And so one of the things that we deal with when we talk about the collection of data, collection of big data especially, is we want to be very careful how we collect and maintain records of human activity. In general, we want to make sure that we're anonymizing as much of this as possible, right? If there is a large collection of data about people who engage in some risky behavior, we don't want to necessarily have insurance companies be able to tap into that and execute their decisions about rates or even coverage based on people's records. We want to make sure that discrimination doesn't occur based on statistical anomalies or phenomena. So we always want to make sure that what we're designing, what we're implementing, takes into account the possible human costs to the tracking of what we do, and we're at this moment because we have so many ways of measuring what we do and tracking what we do. Our cell phones, for instance, are constantly putting out signals to our carriers, to our services, about where we are and what sorts of activities we're up to and what we're thinking about and what we're searching for, and that's a really powerful collection of data. That means that our cell phone companies and the software companies that run our cell phones can know a lot about us, can predict where we're going to go, can predict what we might want to buy, can advise us on restaurants. So there are great conveniences that can come from that. But we also want to make sure that that knowledge is not abused.
Siva Vaidyanathan, it's my understanding that you have noticed that your grocery store has noticed that you no longer purchase diapers.
Right. So, you know, look, like many Americans, I have a discount program with Harris Teeter, with my local grocery store, right? So I give them my phone number every time I go through. I get a discount on a lot of products when I do that. But, of course, the quid pro quo there is that I get a little discount on most of the products I buy, and they get a very rich record of what I've been buying over the years. So when I moved to Charlottesville 6 years ago, I was buying diapers with some regularity, and then at some point, about a year and a half later, I stopped buying diapers. And so Harris Teeter is able to discern from that absence changes in my life, and they're able then to create coupons for me that correspond to their best guess about what my next set of desires might be. So, oh, well, maybe we want to stop giving him coupons for baby food and applesauce and start giving him coupons for chicken nuggets and hot dogs, right? Because, you know, obviously my kid has reached that next point. So that sounds really convenient, and that's a benefit to me. It's a benefit to Harris Teeter. It creates efficiency. It means that they're keeping me and my business because, you know, they're reacting to what I tell them about me. The problem comes, of course, when you're dealing with things like intellectual freedom. If the same activity goes on at a bookstore, or the same activity goes on through Amazon, for instance, and it does, right? We register with these companies. We give them a tremendous amount of information about what things we're curious about. That sort of power can create false impressions. That sort of power, that sort of information in the wrong hands can be used to profile people, and that can cause all sorts of chilling effects, among many other things. So now with Barnes & Noble, no one knows what you're picking up off the shelf and paging through, as long as you put it back on the shelf and you don't buy it. But as soon as you buy it, it creates a rich record that the FBI might want to look at someday. Whereas with Amazon, everything you look at gets traced. Every time you look at a page, every time you do a search, every time you move from one book to another, Amazon's tracking that move, and they're tracking the moves of millions of other people who are doing similar searches, and they're creating a list of tendencies. That's why they're able to recommend, if you're interested in this book, you're probably interested in this book, because lots of other people have done that jump. But it also means that they know a tremendous amount about you, which means they can recommend gifts for you, right? They can recommend things in ways that show that Amazon knows you better than your parents or your spouse knows you, right? I'm sure we've all had that experience, right? So those are real concerns. We really have to make sure that what we're creating is an environment in which people understand the nature of that transaction, people understand the extent of surveillance that they're engaged in, people understand what the possible ramifications might be. They also have to understand the advantages, right? So opting out of being tracked on Facebook, by Google, by Amazon, means a degradation of service. Those services won't provide you the sort of nuanced recommendations that you're used to. And that
Siva,
may be
hold
okay.
on for just a second, because we're going to hit the break here pretty quickly. And before we do, I want to hear a little bit from our third guest. Bill Pearson, you were trained as a microbiologist, but these days you refer to yourself as a computational biologist?
That's right. That's right. And I think it's very interesting to hear the thinking about getting lots of data and doing lots of interesting things with it. One of the issues that we have as a person trained as a molecular biologist and working in computational biology is I wasn't trained as a statistician. So, and people and who are...
Yeah, some of the work that you're doing relates to how people are able to do DNA sequencing
absolutely.
Today.
Absolutely.
Which is, a good enough tease to make me want to stay listening through the break, and we're going to continue our conversation about anything and everything to do with big data in just a bit more than 1 minute. With us by phone, longtime researcher of just about anything and everything to do with mass media, as well as author of the book, The Googleization of Everything, Siva Vaidyanathan. Here with me in the Insight Studio, computational biologist Bill Pearson, as well as system engineering specialist Don Brown. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have a question about anything to do with big data or a theory about how it could be used or misused, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, in all numbers, translates to 888-967-2825. Bill Pearson, let's talk a little bit about DNA and the Human Genome Project.
So in biology, the Genome Project was sort of the introduction of big data. Our DNA has 3 billion nucleotides. These are letters A, C, G, and T. And the goal of the Human Genome Project originally, which I think now is perhaps more than 15 years ago when it started, perhaps almost 20, was to simply find out what all those things were and build the technology and understand what is our DNA, what do our parents give to us, what do we give to our children. And it's very exciting. It came in on time and under budget, and we had all of this information, but we basically knew 3 billion A, C, Gs, and Ts. We did not know how those things worked. So my area of research is in trying to understand how all of these parts actually make a person. And it's been a very exciting thing to do because if you can imagine the analogy is often made with a car. Imagine that you've never seen a car, or perhaps you have seen a car, but you've never been able to take it apart. And then you get a parts list for the car and you want to understand how it works. All you get to see is the car as a whole and all these things in this really, really long list of parts. And you can perhaps look at some of those parts and see what shapes they are, and you might imagine how they fit together. But basically, having all that information only takes you a little bit farther than, or it doesn't take you as far as you'd like to go, for sure, because you can't really build a part, just a car, just by having a list of the parts without actually having the parts themselves. So my work tries to understand how those parts work in largely by understanding how they work in other organisms. It turns out we're all made of the same parts, people and other mammals and bacteria and yeast and plants. We all have mostly the same parts. So we can get to do experiments on things that are not people, and we can understand how those parts work by doing those experiments.
This idea that I've heard you mention before, Bill Pearson, sort of speaks to the notion that if we have more information than ever before, and we have more capability for keeping track of huge amounts of information than we've ever had before, because of ever faster computers, because of mathematical geniuses like your colleague here, Don Brown, who's inventing interesting algorithms, people kind of jump to the conclusion that we're constantly going to be making progress. But you say, wait a minute, part of it depends on what?
Well, I think that's an interesting thing to think about. All the stuff that Don and Siva were talking about, we have all this data and we can do lots of things with this data. And sometimes we can do things with this data and we put it together. We come up with interesting, statistically significant thises and thats. And in fact, they're wrong. And they may be wrong because the data does not mean what we thought it meant, or it might mean because we haven't learned enough statistics. Or it might mean because we're putting together things that really can't be put together again in a useful way, so that there are patterns, but they're patterns that have been generated by chance. They actually haven't been generated by something which is usefully predictive. So it's nice to think, or I don't know, nice. It's perhaps scary to think about how Amazon and all these other people who are collecting all this data can do so much with it, and how we would like them to not do things that are unethical.
Right.
But I think we'd also like them to not do things that are stupid. And
right.
That happens too.
So, yeah. So this is Siva. One of the fascinating things about this era of big data, and look, even though we've been at it for 20 years, we're still babies when it comes to figuring out how to select the data we're going to use, how to mine it correctly, how to compare it correctly, how to write algorithms that adequately reflect our goals and don't reflect our prejudices. You know, those are big challenges. So as Bill just pointed out, like, we can make tremendous mistakes by misanalyzing data, and we've seen this, right? So one common example, the fact that, you know, everybody's had this experience of everyone who's been on Facebook has this experience of having ads targeted to them that are completely inappropriate for them. And it merely reflects some of the words they've chosen to type into particular Facebook entries, right? And that, because Facebook just doesn't have a good algorithm for predicting interest based on expressions in Facebook. It's going to be a while till they work that out. But there are bigger implications of these mistakes. You know, there are well-known records of false positives in national security and in law enforcement where law enforcement or national security agencies are trying to pinpoint activities, trying to connect dots, people moving at different places, people purchasing different products, people fraternizing with known terrorists or criminals, and from that, trying to distill a sense of who might be a threat.
Yeah, I guess that I'd like to jump in here for a second there on that one, Shiva.
This is Don Brown.
Yeah, this is Don Brown. I think that you guys are both right when you talk about the kinds of errors that we can make when we try and analyze large data sets. But I think it's also important to point out that without the analysis of these large data sets, we make enormous errors.
That's right.
And in fact, you know, your comment earlier, Shiva, about the discrimination that's possible with big data. Frankly, we have enormous discrimination without data. I would argue that a lot of the profiling that goes on in law enforcement is because they just don't understand how to analyze data. When they do it on their own, when they do it without data, they actually key in on the wrong things.
Exactly.
And they result in it results in clear racial prejudice and all sorts of very bad things. As the legal case moves forward in New York, we'll find out how that works. But frankly, when you start looking at the data, what you realize is that there are other things that are predictive other than the things that law enforcement and humans in general, we tend to look visually at things and we react. We say, oh, that's different from us. It must be dangerous. Well, in fact, there are other things that are more predictive of what's dangerous. And large data sets expose that more than we get if we just rely on humans looking at it without that kind of thing. That's not to say you're absolutely right. We make enormous mistakes. In fact, some of us have fun with this. The kind of thing you mentioned with your shopping experience.
Yeah.
You can actually go in and you can start playing around with this and messing with them in your shopping habits and actually giving them.
Oh, do give us an example.
And actually giving them information. Well, let's just say a friend once instead of he got a shopping cart, one of these loyalty cards for one of his pets who happened to be a dog, and then shopped accordingly to their taste. It would get certain calls from various vendors and things. Looking for this particular animal, or they'd receive communication. Well, they were looking for this particular shopper and say, sorry, can't come to the phone right now. He's under the table licking his tail.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you can mess with when you know about the way that they're doing, when they're looking at the data. Once you know what's going on, and in fact, that's what makes, you know, you're absolutely right. People are right now going just gangbusters in the marketing area trying to understand this. I don't happen to be one of them, but I certainly know a lot of people who are, and they're actually getting a lot of things that you'd be surprised that they can pull out of it. But frankly, it's very hard because we tend to do this. As soon as we learn that they're doing stuff to us, we tend to move a little bit to create difficulties for them to be able to track us.
Yeah, at least some of us do. Now, one of the problems is, of course, that we're not always made aware of the extent to which we're being tracked and traced and profiled.
Hold on to that thought for just a moment, Steve,
sure.
Because it's something I want to ask you about. But I want to let anyone who's just joined in know that we're discussing big data with researchers Don Brown, Bill Pearson, and by phone, Siva Vaidyanathan. Siva, who specializes in media, especially areas dealing with advertising and what advertisers are doing with big data to track us, can only be with us for about another 10 minutes. So if you've heard him say something that resonates for you or a question for him specifically, please don't put off getting your call in before he has to go away. Our phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825.
Great.
But to you who are listening, I'm curious if there's anything that you've heard that sort of resonates for you. Have you ever been the recipient of, whether as it was Siva was saying, a Facebook ad that was completely inappropriate for you? or have you had concerns about being tracked by law enforcement, or do you know somebody who ended up on a no-fly list for no good reason? We'd love to hear about your experiences and your thoughts. Phone number 888-967-2825. Siva, please go
sure.
ahead.
Well, you know, one of the reasons, I guess the main reason that you're speaking with three professors from the University of Virginia is that the University of Virginia is taking great leaps in this area. Great leaps not only in making sure that we are capable, our scientists are capable of doing this really exciting research, the sort of research that Don and Bill have been doing and are describing, and there are a dozen more really exciting projects going on at UVA. So we're stepping up and becoming a leader in the analysis of data and the tools that we can use to do big data analysis and experiments. But because we're UVA, we're Thomas Jefferson's university, we are steeped in the liberal arts tradition, we are particularly equipped, specifically equipped, to handle questions about law, policy, and ethics, as well as the scientific method, philosophy of science, sociology of science. These are great, fascinating questions that the three of us are just starting to get into. So these sorts of conversations are going on at the University of Virginia every day, and it's one of the really exciting things about working at UVA, and it's one of the few places, I think, in America where you can bring together minds from all these different areas of research and get them in a room to talk through these issues. I mean, we've just scratched the surface of how interesting these questions are going to be. And one of the things I think we can all see from our discussions here is that we have to keep in mind just how exciting and useful these innovations can be, and at the same time check ourselves and make sure we're not too arrogant about what we can create and what we can generate from sets of data. Data is not innocent and not value free, because the actual selection and collection of it involves human decisions. The creation of algorithms to analyze the data is not neutral, because human beings do those things, right, and make decisions and build their values into those algorithms. So if we're doing all of these projects openly, honestly, with a sense of our own limitations, then we're very likely to create some pretty impressive benefits for humanity. But if we do it recklessly and we do it in the dark, we could be creating some pretty big problems.
Siva, I think I've heard you say in the past that when it comes to the overall phenomenon of big data, maybe the biggest problem is concern about lack of transparency.
Right, right. So take the government, right? The fact that the government has all these different ways of tracking us, and many of which we've known for many decades, right? As soon as we had big databases, as early as the early 1960s, big databases to handle massive government efforts, big databases to handle Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, big databases to handle education statistics. We've known that the government has rich ways of making sense of the activity in the United States of America. We also know that the government has all sorts of ways of tracking our communications and tracking our movements, from easy pass to tracking mobile phone activity. And so with that, we've had moments in American history. The early 1970s were the last big moment at which many American people stood up and said, you know what, we need to know more about our government than our government knows about us. And that was a moment in 73, 74, 75, post-Watergate, at the moment when we realized just how badly we had been misled about the war in Vietnam, when we realized the extent to which the powers of the federal government were being abused for partisan purposes, when people from all points of the political spectrum rose up and said, let's build into our laws limitations on what the government can collect and how the government can share information across its agencies. So that's one reason that, for instance, the FBI can't simply call up the IRS and say, give me this data about these five people. There actually has to be due process for those sorts of records to come about. The information doesn't flow that freely. Now, post 9/11, we've undone a significant number of those protections. We've undone them pretty recklessly, and at the same time, we've installed all sorts of ways to track people and all sorts of completely opaque systems of analysis through law enforcement and national security. And so as citizens, we don't have a clear idea of what the government is doing and can do, and we're not allowed to get clear answers on it. And I think that's an unhealthy situation. Now, we have to recognize that too much transparency can put us in danger as well. We need to be able to trust the government with some measure of opacity. But that conversation, we haven't taken a breath, stepped back, and had a mature analysis and debate about it. We've merely been rushing forth with new systems, new technologies, new methods of tracking, and we haven't really been able to make sense of our new relationship with the state, which I think is potentially very dangerous, at least over the past 10 years.
Yeah, and I think it's true as well that we, and this is Don Brown, that we have also not really understood how commercial enterprises are going to make use of this massive amount of data as well. And we don't really understand how to control that either, for better or for worse. And when companies like Google go overseas and they operate in China and they have to operate according to rules there that are different from the rules that they operate here, we're not really quite sure what to make of that either. So there are a number of questions that we just don't really have a good handle on when it comes to dealing with very large data sets in the interest of privacy and values that we espouse as being central to the way that we operate here in the United States.
I've got to say, though, that I mean, I think that certainly the commercial interactions and how they watch us is certainly a very important thing to be thinking about. But Siva, I'm not quite as I'm concerned about the federal government, not because the safeguards are there, but because I'm not sure the competence is there. I think
Right. Mostly
what we know is that there are lots of agencies in the federal government that have lots of information about people, and they almost never share it with each other in a useful way.
Well, we should be worried about competence on both sides, right? We should be worried that perhaps law enforcement and national security are incompetent to the point where they miss obvious threats, as they did on 9/11, as they did basically with the underwear bomber, the Christmas Day underwear bomber 4 years ago, a gentleman who should have been on the no-fly list, should have been on the terrorist watch list. His father had actually reported him to the U.S. consulate, and yet he was allowed to board a plane in Amsterdam for Detroit. That sort of failure shows how badly we've designed systems that often do the opposite, which is create false positives, track the wrong people, harass the wrong people, put the wrong people in a Kafkaesque nightmare, to the point where the late Senator Ted Kennedy found himself on the no-fly list. Young from Alaska found himself on the no-fly list.
We're going to hit the break here in less than a minute, and then you're going to leave us. So before we see you go away, would you please tell us what you think the questions are that you'd like all of us to be asking about this concept of big data?
Yeah, right. Well, I think that every citizen now has an obligation to understand some basic things about statistics and some basic things about computer science, so that at least we're familiar with the language that is being used by insurance companies, by scientists, by hospitals, by the federal government, to make sense of the world. If we're not equipped with that vocabulary and that ability to understand how we're being tracked and traced, we're going to be weaker citizens, and ultimately we could be victims rather than fully engaged citizens.
Siva Vaidyanathan, chair of the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia and author of The Googleization of Everything, thanks so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
We're going to continue with big data researchers Don Brown and Bill Pearson in just about 1 minute. As a microbiologist, Bill Pearson started cloning things, just small proteins at first, back in the early 1980s. He also invented landmark computer programs that are still used all over the world today in the science of DNA sequencing. These days, Dr. Pearson refers to himself most often as a computational biologist. Mathematician and systems engineer Don Brown is also known for very specific kinds of work with computers. Algorithms he's created have been used by the U.S. military in hospital emergency rooms and in law enforcement, just to name a few areas of his involvement. We're talking about big data If you'd like to join the conversation, phone number, easy to remember, is 888-WMRA. Talk, this is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Looks like our first call comes from James, who's been driving along the highway somewhere. James, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, thank you. I'm enjoying the show. It seems to me like this whole conversation or question as to how far we've gone with this is long overdue. I liken this to Pandora's box, or more currently perhaps to nuclear power and technology. You know, nuclear power and the atom bomb and all that seemed like a great idea at the time, helped us end the war and all that. But look where we are now, constantly terrified that nations like North Korea or Iran will get it, or someone even more hot-headed. We are equally blindly leaping into this new world of data without seemingly any thought to the repercussions. But who's to say that we won't end up with a similar scenario? All of this is Pandora's box. We open the box and say, oh, look how pretty the trinkets, and then one day, uh-oh, it's biting us in the butt. I think we need to clamp down on the entire data mining industry and say, all right, let's put some serious measures in place so that the wrong person can't use this. You know, we're constantly hearing in the news that somebody lost a laptop with a million social security numbers and things like that. It's all the same thing. We have blindly leaped into this age of data without really looking at what could happen, because there's always an almighty buck to be made if we spread the data so fast and so furiously. And now it's going to.
James, hold on a second. We've got a pretty clear idea of your view. I want to give our guests a chance to respond.
Okay. First of all, I think your comparison there is not a bad one. I actually tell my students something very similar with regard to the nuclear power, that the kinds of things that we're teaching with regard to how to mine the data actually very similar to opening up capabilities that are very powerful in many respects. However, I think there are a lot of things that are acting as brakes on this, not the least of which is the comment that was made earlier, that a lot of it we're getting, frankly, quite wrong. And so we discover that we're not doing quite as well as we thought, and that tends to slow the progression of these kinds of things and their use in many ways. The other thing that I'll say that you're right with regard to is, I mean, you brought up some of the issues with cyber, and that's another area where, frankly, we're just now experiencing that's a massive area of data collection. It's a massive area of data mining. And frankly, we're now discovering that there are ways that we need to go after figuring out the kinds of attacks that are going on and the kinds of exposure we're getting in that domain.
But the other thing to keep in mind is that unlike nuclear weapons, lots of the things that decisions that are made using big data are decisions that were going to be made anyway. And so we would hope that the decisions would be made better because of big data, and certainly sometimes they're going to be made worse. But I'm not sure that there are sort of lots of new things that, we still have to make choices about what to buy based on how much it costs and the discounts and things like that. So there are certainly new things shaping the information that we're getting, and we're being targeted in much, much, much more specific ways. But somebody was doing something like that when they were making jingles for cigarettes.
James, thank you so much for sharing some time with us here on Virginia Insight. If you listening want to join in, we've got a few more minutes to take phone calls at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or you can post to us on Facebook if you're near a computer and are already online. We're listed on Facebook as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And this is from Doug on our Facebook page. He says, do you see a benefit to having a certain level of ignorance, agnostic point of view, if you will, in a particular domain when dealing with big data? Examples: advertising, marketing, healthcare, environment, law enforcement, sports, etc. Does expertise introduce bias as far as truth and insight?
So as a scientist, I guess I've got to say that one of the reasons that I ended up being a scientist is because I was really good at being a skeptic. And I think that the question that was asked, should you be ignorant? I'm not so sure about that, but you should certainly be skeptical. And The other thing I think to keep in mind is, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, sometimes big data can be misused, or it can be used to draw conclusions which are incorrect. And it's certainly true that we have lots of other ways of drawing conclusions that are incorrect as well. The problem with data is that it seems like it's more true that if you've got a whole bunch of data supporting your perspective, then you must be right. And if the other guy doesn't have a lot of data, then you win and he loses. So understanding that there are different ways of looking at the data, there are different kinds of questions that can be asked of the data, there are different kinds of ways that data can be analyzed, and which is not to say that you can get any answer you want, but it is to say that you need to think about what the alternatives were as people make suggestions about how we should do things.
So I guess my comment to that is that
this is systems engineer Don Brown.
Yeah, this is Don Brown. I guess my comment to this question is that it's a very good point. In fact, I've known both in all these areas, in law enforcement, in medicine, in the military, where there are people who've been doing something for a while and they think they know how to do it, and they really don't. They really have not looked at the data, and they have not looked at it from an objective standpoint. And the result is that they're going in about it in exactly the wrong way. So I don't know if I agree with Bill. It's not really ignorance, but it's really a notion of some skepticism or willingness to really look and change the way you've been operating based on what the data are telling you.
Well, a great question, Doug. Thanks so much. Here with us in the Inside Studio, computational biologist Bill Pearson, as well as systems engineering specialist Don Brown. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Dr. Pearson, back to you. You've done so much work in areas that I think have got to affect the future of medicine and health, or at least have the potential to. I'm curious if when you were hearing James on the phone line a few minutes ago talk so much about having opened a parent Pandora's box, being able to collect so much data and correlate it so fully and so quickly that we're causing problems for ourselves, if you wouldn't be thinking, well, the flip side of that is we know much more about how human DNA works today than we would have otherwise.
Yes, and I guess more importantly, we know that so when we started the Genome Project, we thought that there were going to be, you know, that different people had slightly different DNA, but they were different in certain kinds of ways of mutations and stuff like that. And what we've really learned as a result of this project and some of the other large-scale biology that's been done is that things are enormously more complicated than we imagine, that there are all these differences that nobody ever thought of. We didn't see them because we didn't see them causing disease, or we didn't see them causing people behaving in a certain way. So we didn't know about it. But now we've got lots and lots of data, and we realize that things are a lot more complicated than we thought they were, and I think it's a really good thing. It's one thing to say you're opening a Pandora's box, and the idea is that somehow you're going to get all this stuff that makes you say, well, gee, I'm richer now because I know all this stuff. One of the things that's come out of big data in biomedicine is that we're richer because we now understand that we don't know lots of things, that there's lots more stuff going on. There are lots more possible explanations for diseases. And we've got ways of starting to understand what those things are.
You're a molecular biologist. You most often refer to yourself as a computational biologist. Don Brown, sitting next to you, is a systems and information engineer. Earlier, we had Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a media studies guy. There are lots of other fields of research and expertise involved in this working effort at the University of Virginia to come to terms with the concept of big data. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
What is it, Don Brown, that you're hoping is going to result from this analysis, this big thinking from all these different perspectives?
Well, I think one of the advantages of bringing people together from all these different perspectives is we see the way to analyze data in ways that we never thought of doing it before, because we've been sort of narrowly focused on certain domains. For example, astronomers have ways of doing things that are different, for instance, than computational biologists. And when you merge the two together, they sometimes find that their discovery of relationships is changed by that interaction, by looking at how other people are doing things. And that's what I've always found interesting about moving from one field to another, is that you can frequently discover these kind of characteristics to build algorithms, to build ways to analyze that you wouldn't discover otherwise.
And there are other aspects to big data besides analyzing it. One of the things that is very exciting is that astronomers and high-energy physicists have way, 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 way more data than medical researchers do. But the new technologies in genome science is starting to generate more and more data. So we may be 5 years behind the physicists as far as data volume, but we know the kinds of things that they've done that have worked and the kinds of things that are cost-effective and the kinds of things that, as biologists, we don't think about them because they're sort of more computer science-y or they're more data management and stuff like that. But other people have solved some of these kinds of things.
Bill Pearson, do you ever feel as a scientist that you're just overwhelmed with data? Not perhaps even as a scientist, but as somebody living in the Western world with all of the information that surrounds us, whether it's on radio or television or digital media or driving along the highway with billboards or junk mail. Do you have kind of an extra urge to just sort of step back once in a while and hide in the woods?
So I would just say the opposite of that, I guess. Of course, I don't actually worry so much about the billboards and the television and things like that. But I'm very excited about all the data that I get to look at. And I find it a little frustrating that there's a lot more data than I know how to put together. And I have a lot of fun when I say, well, gee, here's a data set from this source and here's a data set from a different source. And they have some things in common, but they don't really talk to each other very well. But boy, if I did this other thing, then all of a sudden things would make a lot more sense. I think that's just going to happen more and more and more because we've got more data. But just as importantly, the data is much, much more accessible. We heard at the beginning of the session that about how there are these technologies that have been around since the 1960s and 1970s. But I guarantee that there weren't any graduate students with laptop computers at their desks that had access to those technologies then, but they do now. And so they can think about putting things together in ways that, 10 or 20 years ago would have cost enormous numbers of man hours and lots of planning. And they can just say, gee, I wonder if this is true, or I wonder what happens if you put this together with that, and really get some interesting new insights.
Don Brown, do you identify at all with somebody listening who feels like they're going through information overload, or is that kind of the antithesis of your view of the world?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably the antithesis. I love getting massive amounts of data. I'm very much like the survey that was done of people many years ago that said that most people would like to always have a third more income than they have. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. They always want a third more. I'm of the point that I want a third more, and I want a third more processing power. It's amazing. Bill's absolutely right when he says that we have laptops on our students' laps right now, and then they can do things, which frankly for us was a supercomputer. But so we now have students with supercomputers. But the reality of it is that we never have enough processing power. We still want more.
Here with me in the Insight studio, computational biologist Bill Pearson, as well as system engineering specialist Don Brown. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got only a couple of minutes left to wrap up this discussion about big data. But Don Brown, I've heard you use a term a number of times. I'd like you to expand on relationships.
Yeah, when I say relationships, it's really very similar to when we talk about relationships between people. Two people have a relationship with each other. When we look at relationships, we're looking at relationships between data. We're looking at how they connect to each other, how they're linked to each other. And data can be linked to each other in ways that give us patterns. And it's those patterns that describe things that are of interest to us. So an example of a pattern would be that there's a specific kind of a pattern that may be a threat for an IED attack, for example. It may represent an area that's going to be more likely to be attacked because of the terrain that surrounds it. There's just a characteristic that says that an attacker is going to have better visibility, better way to retreat, better all sorts of things. Those kind of patterns are what we're after, and those patterns are basically relationships and data.
Bill Pearson, I think you and I are the only ones who've ever, of the people that have been on today, have ever watched this TV show I mentioned at the outset, Person of Interest, that's based on fictionalized accounts of how to deal with compilations of big data. But I'm curious, Bill, since you've seen that TV show and you know about the theme and the speculation of this genius who uses big data in such interesting ways to help people in their lives, does Don Brown strike you at all as the type of guy who might someday invent that kind of machine?
Well, he would certainly be able to put the data together. I think the good news about Person of Interest is that we don't actually have any of the systems in place to put all that stuff together. So we're pretty safe. The security cameras at the 7-Eleven are really not talking to the IRS right now. But yeah, I think that's the kind of stuff he'd like to play with. And it's a lot of fun.
Our guests have been Bill Pearson, professor and acting chair in the University of Virginia's Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Genetics. Don Brown, the Calcutt Professor of Systems and Information Engineering at UVA. And earlier in the program, Siva Vaidyanathan, chair of UVA's Media Studies Department. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs and then on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about all of our guests and the work they are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.